You're listening to WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.
Check, check, one, two. Hope you like a little country. Rock and roll and blues. Cause we sure love playing for good people like you. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, one, two.
You are listening to Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, the radio show that features conversations with and the music of local musicians and traveling musicians performing in town. I'm your host, Dave Lake. Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I am talking again with Darko Budurak, who was guest conductor of the Savannah Philharmonic back in February for a concert entitled Beethoven's Eroica, which featured Mozart's Marriage of Figaro Overture, Saint-Saëns Cello Concerto No. 1, and Beethoven's Symphony No. 3, Eroica. When we talked back in February, we didn't have a chance to talk about the centerpiece of the concert, and that's Beethoven's Eroica Symphony. So we are back to talk about that tonight. Welcome back to Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, Darko Budurak.
Thank you so much, Dave.
The last time you were on the show, we talked about Mozart's Marriage of Figaro Overture, and I think that it is a very interesting companion to Beethoven's Symphony No. 3, Eroica.
I do find it fascinating to have Mozart's Marriage of Figaro on paired with Eroica, because between 1786, when Mozart's Marriage of Figaro was composed, and 1805, when Eroica premieres, written in 1803, 1804, but 1805 is the premiere, in those basically 20 years, the world changes, and it still has remained changed up until to this day because of the revolutions. We can count the American Revolution as being part of that movement in 1776, but especially in Europe, the French Revolution. And so, in a way, Mozart's overture is a little tight, compressed piece, which gives you the impact of the drama of the entire opera in some 4 minutes of music. And it secures you. It says, yes, this will happen, and this is how it's supposed to happen. And in a way, I will not challenge you. I will entertain you, and here's the piece. And of course, what happens because of the revolution, Vienna and the Habsburg Empire go through kind of a social economic upheaval. Beethoven comes to the scene, and here's a composer on the second half of the program who gives you the most challenging work ever created by in the history of the world at that time. So the aesthetic is completely different. You couldn't have more different pieces in terms of their intent. One securing you, one guaranteeing entertainment, the other one saying, I will shake you to your entire philosophical core on the second half and present the longest piece of symphonic music ever conceived on a scale twice as big as anything ever existed in a symphony, and will change the symphonic world forever 20 years later, basically.
And it's interesting that you mentioned revolution, because you cannot really separate music from politics.
Certainly at this time. Yeah.
And it continues too, because, you know,
it does.
Wagner, for instance, was a revolutionary in himself, and he revolutionized opera, for instance. But here, as you point out, the Mozart is to be expected. It is a statement of expectations and expectations delivered on. But the Beethoven really changes the world of music, because of changes in the world of politics. Part of the reason, I think, although Mozart was really different, he did have commissions from royalty, but he was probably one of the more entrepreneurial, sort of like Handel, a little bit entrepreneurial in his writing. But Beethoven, even in his early works, they were commissioned and dedicated to the royalty, the Habsburgs. And His first two symphonies were in the same line of that meeting expectations.
Absolutely.
But number
Exactly.
three just blew the world of music up and actually was people writing about music at the time were very divided on this work.
It was too much for them. It was too much. Imagine going nowadays, like it would be the equivalent of going to the movie theater, expecting a 2, 2.5 hour movie. All of a sudden, you're trapped inside a 4 hour epic without knowing it. That's what it felt like. A symphony lasted typically 25, 28 minutes, 30 minutes if we take all the repeats in Mozart and go on a slower side. This is as long as the symphony went. The Beethoven lasts a proper 50 minutes, if not longer. What's amazing about it, of course, is that time does not feel long. That's the genius of Beethoven, is that he created a work that is compelling from the first sound to the last. You're taking on a musical journey, and it's a gripping musical journey that holds you. So this is why it's one of the greatest pieces ever written.
And the first movement, marked Allegro con brio, opens slapping you in the face. I mean,
Another great example.
there's no introduction. It just slaps you in the face with these two strong chords. And then it goes to the introduction that you may be expecting. A series of sort of string work with some insertions by the woodwinds and then a little bit of brass and timpani and with a crescendo that leads out of that slower part. So he begins very strongly and then more conventionally, perhaps, what some people might have been expecting at the very beginning. But throughout the first movement, there's a sort of alternation between these pianissimo, more contemplative passages that are often with string ostinato and woodwinds. And then you have these fortissimo, full orchestra passages. And there's probably more forzando markings in this first movement than ever in a piece of music.
Certainly, no doubt. We have to mention for listeners, Beethoven noticed he was going deaf a year prior to starting the Eroica. And I think this is the price Beethoven had to pay to create something like this. Because in a way, in a time, you have to think like the entire world order, the worldview has been shaken. We live in pretty turbulent times. This was even more turbulent in the Vienna that Beethoven was living in. So if we look at the world of Mozart these 2 decades earlier, what really, really changed was the economic crisis in society. It was massive inflation brought on by multiple wars. And as a result of keeping power, the monarchy repressed the society. There was censorship. There were spies, conversations were listened to. It was not as kind of this liberal enlightenment that existed in Mozart's time. And Beethoven, who's not from Vienna, he's a foreigner coming from Bonn, from Germany, and Bonn is on the River Rhine, which is the traditional boundary between French and German peoples. And so it's no surprise that the French revolutionary ideas come to Bonn, which is a university town. Beethoven is inspired by that, comes to Vienna at a time of unrest, believes in the Enlightenment ideas, believes in the kind of a modern concept of liberty, and then loses his hearing. So he can say, I don't care what happens to me. I can do something remarkable because I am already, in a way, lost as a musician, as a composer. I cannot hear any longer. I can take risks I would not have been able to take, like Mozart or Haydn, who were dependent on the system that existed. So Beethoven comes in, creates this crazy piece, as you said, has more sforzandos, sharp accents in a movement than ever created before. It's true, he's able to experiment and create something new because it doesn't matter anymore. His life, as he says himself, is devoted entirely to music. He could have taken his own life. He thought about it. He said, no, I'm going to stay alive to basically express my ideals through my music. And so this piece is wildly shocking as a result of its context and of the personal struggle that Beethoven went through. And on top of it all, the idea of the piece was to dedicate it to Napoleon Bonaparte, who at the time of the work's creation was seen as the person who would bring these liberal ideas of freedom, of equality, from France to the rest of Europe. And of course, in 1804, he puts a crown in his head. And Beethoven, in fury, destroys the front page of the Mark manuscript. You can see the hole where Napoleon's name used to be. And that's how we have the name Eroica, in honor of the hero who once was, basically. So it's really not a symphony about Napoleon. It's a symphony of Beethoven expressing his own idealistic views of what society should be like. And as a result, you have this hyper-dramatic piece.
Well, as you said, Eroica is heroic. And that is really the theme of this first movement, is one that is heroic. Because you have military horn calls as well, as you go through
Yes.
this first movement, bringing in the sense of maybe a military hero.
Yes, there is certainly the big thing with Beethoven that becomes his trademark and really asserts itself in this work is the idea of struggle. So how you depict struggle in music, sudden changes in dynamics, loud, soft, loud, soft, that happens throughout the work. There's the harmonic side. In the very, very first six measures, we have a note that does not belong in the key of E flat. We have a C sharp in the bass. It's not supposed to be there. That's completely foreign key. Mozart, Haydn would only have done that as a joke. With Beethoven, it's a structural element. You'll hear it in the main line, in the melody, which is in the cello. So the aspect of harmony is far denser and more conflicted. So this idea of tension building is really new. And the typical work, again, this movement takes about 17 minutes to perform. The longest movement we have up to this point is probably something like, you know, Jupiter Symphony first movement, 8-9 minutes long. This is twice as big. Beethoven doesn't focus on the themes. We can joke about his melodic writing that maybe he didn't have the gift of gab for melody like Mozart did, who was, you know, wrote some of the best melodies in history. But Beethoven, basically the focus of the movement is not happening on the melodies, but on how he develops them. So there's this idea of development. We introduce a set of melodies, which is what happens in the first 100 bars of the piece. But then about 300 bars of the movement are spent with conflict of those ideas. They're developed, they're crushed against each other, they're taken to extreme keys. Strange dissonances appear throughout the movement. So the idea of struggle, Beethoven is giving you this message. Here's this heroic music, but you don't get it for free. You don't get a happy D major like you did in Marriage of Figaro. You have to earn it. And even when we finish the first movement and E flat major is established as a really kind of a home base, a happy key, you know the piece is not over. There's too much tension in the first movement to be allowed to exist on its own. The piece has to continue. You've set up an epic. It would be like finishing season one of a great drama, and you know, you have to wait another year to see it. You know it has, there's much more ahead. And that's what Beethoven achieves with this movement.
And this first movement ends with these two final crescendos and ending with these two strong chords. Sort of
just like how it started.
As a finale, but as a introduction to the future.
Thank you. Thank you.
And what does he do next? What's the next step that we get in the piece?
We have a hero.
We have a hero.
We have a hero, but apparently the hero dies because the second movement is a march of funebre, and it's marked adagio assai.
This is WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.
You're listening to WRUU, your local radio station, for people just like you, hosted by people from your community. The voices you hear are your neighbors, coworkers, and others from the Savannah and Lowcountry area. In other words, WRUU is your community radio station. Please help us by donating whatever you can to help your neighbors and friends stay on the air. Go to WRUU.org and support your local radio station. Any amount is welcomed. Thank you for your support of WRUU.
Art Southeast has announced an artist talk with Hannah Keats, the Arts Southeast May On View Artist in Residence, on Wednesday, May 27th at 6 p.m. at Arts Southeast, 2301 Bull Street, Savannah. Hannah Keats focuses on creating biomorphic sculptural paintings and installations inspired by nature and science fiction. More information at artsoutheast.org/Hannah-Keats.
This music is often called classical music, but remember, Mozart, Beethoven, and Liszt were the rock stars of their time, so I simply call it great music. I'm your host, Dave Lake, and join me for four centuries of great music, with new episodes each week on Sundays from 3 to 5 p.m. We also have encores of these episodes on Saturdays from 3 to 5 p.m. from mid-June to early December.
Welcome back to Music Local and Sustainable, and I'm your host, Dave Lake. Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I am talking again with Darko Budurak, who was guest conductor of the Savannah Philharmonic back in February for a concert entitled Beethoven's Eroica, which featured Mozart's Marriage of Figaro Overture, Saint-Saëns Cello Concerto No. 1, and Beethoven's Symphony No. 3, Eroica. We are back to talk about the centerpiece of the concert, and that's Beethoven's Eroica Symphony.
The second movement is a march of funebre, and it opens very quietly and mournfully in the strings. And it opens very quietly and mournfully in the strings.
This is a very unusual choice. So a funeral march doesn't exist as part of the symphony. Just by choosing this genre of music, Beethoven is showing us this is not a symphony for your listening pleasure like it used to be 20, 30 years ago, when the aristocracy would be listening to the symphony in the comfort of their own chamber music hall, right, in the palaces. This is meant for public consumption. Vienna, by the way, is a place obsessed with funerals. They love funerals. They do them better than anybody else. They're grand. The horses look spectacular. They have feathers on them. There's incredible music. It's always a spectacle. So it's interesting. If we look at the idea of mourning somebody, Haydn gives us in his 44th symphony, we have the mourning symphony, so-called. I know it was titled afterwards, but he gives us the idea of how we can expect grief and sorrow to be manifested. You express the emotion. Beethoven gives us the entire scene. It becomes a public funeral march. You could almost play the opening of this movement in a procession and it wouldn't feel out of place. That's where the dramatic we talked about really appears. And of course, because it's Beethoven, it's not just a little march. No, the march is made on a grand scale. It returns, the theme we hear at the opening returns multiple times in different guises with different intensity. And in between, we have both a music in C major, which feels like reflecting on the life, kind of standing at the funeral and remembering the beautiful moments of the person who passed. And then, interestingly, we also have a fugue. And a fugue is a device from church music. So you're bringing the public and the learned together in a movement. It's very unusual. It would have been very shocking for the audience to say, hang on, this is what I usually hear when I hear the organist play in church. And suddenly it's combined with music that I hear when I go in the street and somebody famous dies. What's going on here? It's a very innovative movement and very dramatic. And again, the movement doesn't conclude with the feeling of, oh, the dearly departed has ascended to heaven and everything was good and beautiful. No, it actually brings back this mournful theme we hear at the beginning, the funeral march theme, and it's fragmented into silence. It loses notes, it loses harmony. You're literally left with silence and then a C minor chord at the end to finish. So again, the piece is not over. We're not done yet. There's more to come.
And it's this mixing of the funeral march, as you said, that appears again and again and again, but not in its original form until the very end. It appears in these variations, but it's very clearly, it's very distinct, it's very audible, but it's, you hear these interesting variations as he goes through. So it's not only changing the mode in terms of the idea of a funeral march, it's also putting the idea of theme and variations as a as something that you can put in a symphony. Because up until that time, most of the movements were, say, in sonata form, you know. But this is a theme and variations, which, again, is very unusual.
There is a way to analyze the second movement also as being a form of sonata form while being a theme and variations. One of the troubles of analyzing a piece like this is the methods of analysis that we use in music came to fore after these works were composed. So in a way, we're taking a 19th century concept to an older piece and trying to make it fit. And it kind of does, but it fits in none of our molds. It's not a theme and variations. It's not sonata form. It's not a march with a trio. It's all of them at the same time. And this is kind of what's incredible about the piece. This is why it keeps attention. This is why it's convincing.
And with the third movement, he continues to break the mold.
Very much.
Not only that, this work in its total, but this work, particularly with the third movement, and particularly with the differences, the way he treats the first and second movements, really becomes the model for at least a century.
Yes. So even, first of all, the third movement is titled a scherzo. Scherzo means joke in Italian. The previous two symphonies, when Beethoven writes his first symphony, he titles it Menuetto. It's fast. It sounds to what our ears a scherzo is, but it's not titled that yet. And scherzo now takes the idea of a triple time movement that goes rapidly fast and is almost virtuosic in character. In this particular work, it serves to bring back kind of a new vitality. If we look at the second movement as being as our hero has died, maybe the idea of the hero, what the hero fought for, continues to live among the people. That could be one interpretation. And there is a vitality coming back, but there's also music about vitality. We ended with dissolution in the previous movement. We fragmented and went to silence. Now we're coming back out of silence with this incredible nervous energy. And amongst other innovations that this piece presents, there is an instrumental innovation as well. Beethoven, for the first time, brings a third horn player into the symphony, third French horn. And so what this allows is for horns to be used with more presence in general through the symphony, but particular in this movement, it allows for really compelling and unique sound for the trio section of the scherzo. So the middle part of the third movement sounds like a hunting scene because it's three horns playing in harmony, presenting their hunting call, if you will. And so interestingly, if we look at the menuet, which is the predecessor, again, let's go back to Mozart and Haydn. The menuet is a courtly dance, literally invented by Louis XIV, the grandest king of them all. It's the most aristocratic thing that exists. Beethoven gives us a movement where we have basically a life force followed by a nature scene out of the palace. We're not in the palace anymore. We're amongst the people. There's the energy of the people, and there's the beauty of nature together presented in this particular moment. In my subjective opinion.
The idea of the playful, it opens quietly and playfully in the strings with a very rhythmic ostinato, and then you get the melody and the woodwinds echoed in the strings. And so it's really the playing with that interaction between the strings and the woodwinds, but in a very playful manner. Rather than a courtly dance, we have, as you said, among the populace. And when the populace have a party, it's not courtly. It is complex. It is energetic. It is diverse. And that's what you hear in these playful sections that is the scherzo and named scherzo. It's really interesting to listen to other music of this period, even into the middle of the 19th century. They'll occasionally use the word scherzo as a movement, like a third movement, but it reverts back to the minuet. You know, when you have minuet and trio, people, that really is still consuming a lot of composition, particularly in the, it's gradually leaving the symphonic world, but it's still very heavy in, say, the chamber music world.
Yes. Even the Saint-Saëns concerto, the middle of the concerto has a minuet that I think evokes maybe more Couperin than Mozart or Haydn, but Saint-Saëns is intentionally going back to an 18th century model in the middle of a romantic concerto. So yes, the minuet doesn't go away entirely, but this is the place where it does begin to go away.
And a lot of composers, symphonic composers, particularly Germanic Austrian symphonic composers, really take it and run with the idea of the scherzo. But it's still in the similar structure of entity trio and return to the entity.
Yes.
And in this case, he tags a coda at the very end as well. But it's still in that familiar milieu. It's just a very, very unique approach to that familiar milieu.
Yeah, the proportions are much larger. So Beethoven's, as you called it, entity, his first part, is almost as long as, say, a Haydn or a Mozart minuet would be, just by itself. And then we have the big middle section and then the big return and the coda, as you mentioned. So again, the scale is just, there's a fascinating thing psychologically which happens that Beethoven obviously was very conscious in this when he was writing. This idea of creating something at large scale and then repeating it, it almost as if it creates its own inertia. It creates a tension by the size of it, if that makes sense. Because something is big, we hear repeated multiple times, it adds weight to the entire experience, which, of course, the entire direction is for it to be released in the last movement. Thank you.
Well, this movement reflects the rest of the symphony in the sense of, and again, maybe I'm just looking too deep, but you started it.
That's fine. Let's do it.
It is the death of perhaps the royalty in the second movement and the opening of a world of the peasant. And that is the playful opening. But we also have another group who are emerging at this point, and that is the wealthy non-royal. So the business class is emerging at this point. And I think of the horn calls as a hunt. But it's not the royal hunt that we used to see, but it's now the hunt of perhaps the more business class, the more rich non-royalty. And so he's introducing to you a new civilization emerging in Europe. So a movement that is just a socioeconomic statement.
We can definitely run with this. We can also mention that this piece was not as financed by the aristocracy as it was previously. The financial model has changed by now. And Beethoven, in a way, the entire weight of producing this concert, of presenting this piece, there is aristocratic patronage element, but most of it will come from ticket sales. And ticket sales will be bought by the city merchants and the regular people. So it's not funded by being, you're a Kapellmeister, you're writing for the court, your salary is guaranteed. Beethoven's own financial well-being is on the line by creating this. He put himself on the line. And so I think there is more to explore here in the economic aspect. It's a fascinating time, really. It was so turbulent. The year the piece was premiered, it was premiered in April. By the end of that year, Napoleon marches into Vienna. Literally, the French take over the capital of the Habsburg Empire that's been around for nearly 1,000 years. It's amazing. It's such upheaval, and it's no wonder that such music was produced at such a tumultuous time.
And it's a model that we pretty much still follow in terms of the support of music. Ticket sales and contributions by merchants, we'll say the more well-off individuals in a community.
Yeah.
And then the fourth movement starts right off the bat with this vigorous fortissimo opening and with runs in the strings, with the punctuation with woodwinds and brass. And first little segment ends with the really forzando chords.
Basically says, listen to me now. I got something really spectacular to show you. And what does Beethoven do? So he sets up the expectation. Something incredible will happen. And you hear a theme. So he's setting you up for a theme and variations. It becomes very clear this theme is going to be variated because it's incredibly simple. And if I may say, comically silly. Boom, 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 boom. What is this? No harmony? It's silliness itself. And of course, the genius is that out of this silliness, a most beautiful creation will ensue. This, of course, is a material that Beethoven wrote earlier in his life. He wrote it as the Eroica Variations, Opus 35, and it was used in his Prometheus Overture. The story goes that there was a composer who was in Vienna who challenged Beethoven to an improvisation duel or something like this. And he dared to use Beethoven's theme and write variations on it. So Beethoven, when it was his turn, he took the cello part of the composer's piece, turned it upside down, and what he played was the Eroica theme of the last movement of the symphony. And so it literally comes as I can take your trash and make the most beautiful thing out of it. Incredible.
And the delight of this last movement, too, is the variety of this last movement. Because after this pretty regular but very forceful opening, there's this wonderful quiet pizzicato in the strings that's enjoined by the woodwinds with a periodic fortissimo chords in the brass. But then he switches to the theme with the arco strings and eventually joined by the rest of the orchestra. So it's really a lot of interconnections. And again, it's the combination of these quiet sections and these more fortissimo sections alternating with one another. But I love the way he does these quiet sections because every one of these quiet sections is unique to itself. Yes, heavily strings, perhaps with the rhythmic ostinato, but with various woodwinds in the quieter passages, flute, bassoon, clarinets.
Again, this is one, just like what we talked in the second movement, how you can't find the mold to fit what this movement is. So I'll share with you what all exists. So we have a five-way introduction. We have a theme, which is just the base of the theme. Then we get the second voice of the theme, and both are going to be varied in about seven different variations. We have two fugues. We have then an apotheosis that both actually reflects to Mozart's Marriage of Figaro. At the very end, there is a phrase which recounts the fourth act of the Marriage of Figaro, the moment when the Count asks for forgiveness, Contessa Perdono, literally in the same key. And then you have this incredible apotheosis where the secondary theme of the variation recalls the first movement theme. So we have pa-ri-ri-pa-ram in the first movement becomes pa-ri-ya-ri-ra-ri-ra-ram, etc. in the fourth movement. So it's as if the entire piece, the last movement, gives you all different styles of music that Beethoven was able to present. I forgot, there's also a little pirate march in the middle of the last movement, just for fun. And in a way, it connects back to the first movement. And then after all that, there is a fiery coda to finally end the piece. Unbelievable. Still a challenge to perform 220 years later. Still a very difficult piece for the orchestra to present, and still an incredible thing to experience as an audience member.
Now, the Beethoven in this last movement reflects the first movement of this symphony.
Right.
But the conductor who programmed this particular piece knows that it also reflects the Marriage of Figaro, which is the first piece of the concert.
Right.
That is scale of programming.
Well, that's a lucky coincidence, but it always makes me smile whenever I get to that moment. If you know the piece, it's where kind of the slower music begins at the end of the fourth movement. The oboe has a beautiful solo, and that's kind of the reflection to Marriage of Figaro there. Nothing exists in a vacuum, you know?
Exactly.
In case of Beethoven, it's interesting to see what happened later in his career when he wrote massive pieces, specifically when he wrote the Fifth and Ninth Symphonies, which are other works that can compare to Eroica in terms of weight and length. Both pieces have much longer codas than Eroica does. And to me, it almost feels like, in a way, he didn't know quite how to end the piece at the end of the Third Symphony. So anyway, that's not directly related to Eroica itself, but it's an interesting thing to compare Beethoven's evolution of how to treat a really massive philosophical work, how to end it and complete and round it off. It works. It's just it gets even better later.
Thank you. Thank you.
Tonight on Savannah Music, Local and Sustainable, I have been again talking with Darko Budurak, who was guest conductor of the Savannah Philharmonic back in February for a concert entitled Beethoven's Eroica, which featured Mozart's Marriage of Figaro Overture, Saint-Saëns Cello Concerto No. 1, and Beethoven's Symphony No. 3, Eroica. Last time we talked extensively about and listened to Mozart's Marriage of Figaro and Saint-Saëns Cello Concerto No. 1. But tonight we talked about and listened to excerpts from Beethoven's Symphony No. 3, Eroica. And Darko, I want to thank you so very much for taking the time to talk with me again.
Thank you so much, Dave. I really appreciate it. It's been really fun talking to you.